Hi, Nessa from StudyClix here. The following is the audio from a live webinar featuring StudyClix co-founder and CEO Luke Saunders in conversation with Dr. Coleman Nochter, a child psychologist and Irish Examiner parenting columnist. The webinar was recorded on the 8th of September 2026 and aimed to answer all the questions parents have about how to set their children up right for the school year ahead. The webinar featured a live Q&A at the end, with Dr. Coleman taking questions from parents watching in real time. For more tips and resources to help you support your child through secondary school, check out the Parent Centre on StudyClix. The link is in the description. I'll pass it over to the lads now. I hope you enjoy listening.
Okay, welcome along, guys. My name is Luke Saunders. I'm one of the founders of StudyClix. I'm also a former teacher of biology, geography, and maths. I'm based here in Sligo. And I'd like to welcome our guest tonight. It's Dr. Coleman Nochter. Coleman is a child and adolescent psychotherapist. He's an Irish Examiner columnist, and he's also a lecturer in child and adolescent mental health in SETU, and our Southeast Technological University. And he's also the host of the Asking for a Parent podcast. And maybe before we kind of jump right into it, I might give you a little background just on what this is all about. So in StudyClix, many of you might have heard of StudyClix through your school getting it for your child, or it might be through you might have got it for yourself for your child. StudyClix is Ireland's main teaching and learning website for second level. And the whole idea of it is really to support your child to learn the subjects and reach the potential that they are trying to reach in all of the various subjects. So what I want to do tonight really is just ask Coleman a series of questions, and I'd encourage you in the chat, if you have any additional questions, please share them. You can do that by putting in the chat. Just to note as well that the webinar has been recorded, and put the questions in. And I always do try and get to at least some of the questions, and then we often use those questions as a backup for future webinars. Okay, so maybe Coleman, maybe we start by just you tell us a bit about yourself. So I know I've introduced you in terms of being a child and adolescent psychotherapist, but you're also a father yourself. Would that be correct?
That's right. Yeah, I've three children, 16, almost 14 and 11. Yeah. So transitioning over primary to secondary school has been the theme in this house for the last few years, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And one of your children has just done the junior cert. Would that be right?
That's right. My eldest lad just started in TY this year. So we've just been through our first state exam here as a family, for sure.
Okay. And I suppose one of the interesting things I read in prep for this webinar this evening was, I might quote it to you actually. It says, you cannot make a young person study. You can create conditions, offer support, remove distractions, provide structure, and even impose consequences. But the decision to sit down, focus, and apply themselves rests solely with them. And I just thought that was a really interesting point. It was kind of like going, it's not all on the parent. It's actually, you know, you have to kind of give a little bit of control and realize you can't control everything here.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working with children and families for over 25 years now. And so over that time, you know, I've never seen a circumstance where, you know, say, for example, nagging worked. Do you know what I mean? It's not a situation where a child or a teenager, you know, is being told off consistently for not doing enough work, and they'll just turn around of their own accord and say, actually, you know, you're right, I'll just get stuck into it now. It tends to have to be an internal motivation, and there's so many different, I suppose, variables at play that decide whether a child is motivated or not. And sometimes that's structure, sometimes it's opportunity, but oftentimes it's temperament, you know. And temperament is something you have to work with rather than work against. You know, it's not, we don't tend to believe that we can make a meek child kind of fiery, and it's not about making a fiery child meek. It's almost trying to work with those things. And so for something like study, where you're trying to, entice a child to learn. Like, we can't impose adult standards on children. They have to kind of come to a point in their life where they realize that themselves. So many parents, you know, and I've seen high levels of stress. People ring me, call me all the time saying, I just can't get them to study, or I just can't get her to study. And I've told them 100 times what they need to do, but they just won't do it. Again, I think from the point of view of the nagging, the persistence tends to not yield the results. When I say about, you know, encouraging a child, it's about, you know, almost, I suppose we have to see ourselves as shepherds of our children, not engineers, right? And so you're trying to create an environment where even if they do a half an hour and they come downstairs, it's about, you know, rewarding the effort of that and saying, well done. Well, at least you did that. I mean, that's good, and that's a good start, rather than, well, your sister used to do 2 hours at this stage, or, you know, and comparison and all of these things that we try as parents are meant with love and with the best of intentions. It's just, we psychology would tell us that they're not very effective in terms of, you know, we need to entice children to motivate themselves to try and work for themselves, as opposed to trying to convince them that our idea of what they should do is better than theirs, you know.
Yeah, it's really interesting. As I said, I used to teach maths, and maths is one of those subjects where you'd often at a parent teacher meeting, and in the parent teacher meetings I used to do in Enniscrone, the child was there as well. So you'd have child, parent, and me, and you'd have a child sitting there in front of you, and the parent would say, "No wonder he's getting bad results. I was terrible at maths as well." And you're like, don't compare your child with, you know, your negative perceptions of things. And then the other thing that you definitely don't want to be doing is comparing siblings. I think you just mentioned that. Like, it's one of the worst things you can do as a parent is expect all your children to be the exact same. Think of someone compared you to your own siblings in your own family. So yeah, they're two big no-nos. One of the questions that was submitted prior to the call, someone sent an email, which I think is going to be echoed by a lot of parents, because I think it really touches a nerve. And it was from a parent of a child who's just come into first year, right? And that's the same situation I'm in. My little girl has just started last week in a school here in Sligo. And the question the parent has is that, like, they have this dilemma about, you know, should my child just be doing their homework, or should they be studying beyond what they're getting for homework, right? Now, this is a first year child. And the parent has this dilemma of, like, they don't want to put their child under too much pressure, but they also don't want their child to feel pressure, and therefore the parent is feeling worry. Have you come across that kind of dilemma of wanting to help them make sure that they are studying, but then don't want to overpressure them?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes down to what you constitute as help, right? So, for me, a child starting first year, especially in these few weeks and months, is challenged with so much new stuff, and it's life stuff. This is not necessarily academic, but trying to navigate new corridors, having to work with the personalities of maybe 9 different teachers, trying to make friends in a whole 120 people within your year, and you've just come from primary school. Like, that's so overwhelming. If you were trying to do that as an adult, you would struggle. So for me, and again, I speak from a psychotherapy point of view, not a teaching point of view, what I would be saying is the academic piece would have to take a back seat for me, at least until they settle in. You know, I really would be focusing on that child feeling comfortable, and feeling and not feeling under pressure. And what I would say is that, you know, sometimes what we as parents perceive as help might be like, I remember chatting to one child, and she was completely overwhelmed. She was kind of getting very stressed about, you know, summer exams in first year and really working herself up into this. And, you know, I was saying to the parents that I thought she might need some support. And the parents were saying, okay, well, we'll get her grinds. And I was saying, no, the support she needs is actually just to take a weekend off and to feel that that's okay. And like with everything, you know, we tend to underestimate the value of a rest period. Like, if you're trying to train a muscle and you're working it all the time, you don't take any rest, no growth takes place. Your brain is similar. You know, you almost need to have those rest periods built in. And I can see what this parent is trying to say. They're going to say, I want her to not struggle when it comes to exam time at Christmas so that she'll have that extra bit done. But for me, if she's managing her homework, she's managing to navigate the corridors, she's managing to make a few friends, that for me is a success, you know. And it's not about, when the child is starting first year, it's not about making sure there's no adversity, it's reassuring them that if adversity happens, that you're there for them. You know what I mean? Like, we sometimes tell children, but before they go into secondary school, everything's going to be fine. You're going to be perfect. And then 3 days in, they forget something, or they get in trouble for being late for a class or something. And they said, "You lied. You told me it was going to be okay." Rather than saying everything's going to be okay, what you're trying to say is, if something isn't okay, we will manage it and we will deal with it. And that's a kind of common misconception, Ian or Luke, about mental health. You know, we have this idea that it's to be happy all the time. Mental health is not about being happy all the time. It's about being able to cope with the adversity of life that inevitably happens. So as a parent, you're there trying to coach them through difficulties rather than trying to bypass them, shortcut them, or make sure that they don't happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it really does. Yeah, it's that magic word we hear a lot called resilience, right? You're trying to build resilience in the child, isn't it? Like, and I think, yeah, like, and I suppose so many advice I would give to that parent is like, really listen to the school, right? So if the school are giving your daughter, a certain amount of homework in first year, that's what they intend for her to do, right? She doesn't need to go beyond what she's getting in school. And I would always say one of the most important things you can do as a parent in first and second year is actually just to really pay attention at the parent-teacher meetings and listen to what the teachers are telling you. Because if there is issues, that's when you're going to hear about it. And you really, don't just kind of skip through it going, oh, she loves maths, she doesn't like English. Do take your time. Like I would see a lot of parents coming in with a notepad and they're like, they're jotting down things. They really ask questions. It's one of the most important hours of a term as a parent, right? Because your teachers are spending, or your child's teachers are spending a lot of time with them. They're the ones who'll actually be able to tell you what this child could do more of or do less of, and so on. So that's just something I would suggest. One of the
Just
things,
to add to
yeah, go
that,
on.
Luke, sorry, September isn't always a kind of a referendum of how the whole year is going to go. Lots of people struggle to acclimatize in September, coming off the summer, sleep cycles a bit all over the place, trying to get back into routine. There is an adjustment period that oftentimes settles. So a bad Tuesday in September doesn't mean you're going to have a bad Tuesday all the way until May, and again, it's maybe trying to hold on to our own sense of uncertainty as a parent, and allowing that to kind of settle down naturally would be key. It's not, involvement isn't always the right answer. Sometimes these things just take a little bit of time to settle down, and maybe as a first time parent coming through that first year, I know when I was journeying through it for the first time, it took a little bit of myself reassuring myself that this will settle, and in most cases, it will,
Yeah, totally. I agree with that. Yeah, it's an exhausting time. I think you mentioned this already, but like, the kids are so tired. Like I see it even, I have children in primary school as well. They're coming home and they're falling asleep on the couch. Everyone is just tired, and we even see it in study cliques. Like this time of year, we get all the students set up in the various schools, and like they're taking in so much information. Like what's my timetable? Where's my locker? How do I get the bus home? And then suddenly it's like, right, and there's this study website is going to help you. We always say, like, if you're going to train up students, give it till kind of October when they're kind of in the rhythm, they know what they're doing, they know what they know how now is the time to go and use a resource like StudyClick. So just don't be rushing everything. It's literally week one back. And I'd also echo that point you said about, the best thing that can happen in first year, for example, is just that your child forms good social groups, is happy, and I suppose, the contrary to that, I hear a lot of it when I visit staff rooms is school refusal behaviors. I'm sure you've seen that in your clinics and so on over the year. Have you seen an increase in that over time, and any advice to parents who are experiencing that type of behavior?
Yeah, I mean, again, there's lots of terms around that. I mean, school refusal, school avoidance, school anxiety. We would definitely have seen an increase in that, probably more notably post pandemic. We're seeing quite a bit more of that. And again, there's oftentimes very different reasons for that. It's for some children, like when if a young person's coming to me and they're anxious about going to school, we'll talk about, is it the teachers? Is there a kind of a personality clash? Is it the work? Is it too hard, or is it too difficult? Is it the peer group? Is it the friends, or that you're not making friends, or are you experiencing bullying, exclusion, anything like that? Or is it just the atmosphere, the whole structure of having to sit for such a long time, not having exit routes, all of that sort of stuff? Sometimes they'll say all of them. Sometimes it'll be one. There can be so many variables that makes going to school difficult for a child. And it's important to say, our school system suits certain children, and it maybe doesn't suit others. It's the system we have, and we have to kind of work around it and with it. And there's lots of schools who, if you're explaining to the teacher or the year head what the difficulty is, can be really creative and supportive around getting your child into school. And sometimes it's about maybe a little bit of creative timetabling, where they might go in a little bit later, come home, and trying to build that up gradually. But trying to allocate the source of what it is that makes school difficult, and trying to put in as much supports around that, is the best way to get a child back into school and back into a school. We sometimes obsess about, how do we get this child back to school? Maybe the first question is, why are they finding it difficult? And that may oftentimes, I oftentimes say, like, a behavior is oftentimes not the problem. It's a signpost to the problem. So the child who is really struggling to go to school, the answer is not how do we get them to school, but maybe what might be causing that. So rather than gathering around the signpost, it's important to kind of see where it's pointing, because oftentimes it can be a child is lonely. They don't have anyone to pal around with in between breaks. Maybe it is that the school work is noticeably more difficult than maybe, and that's an important part. Like, in primary school, a child might be very used to getting 10 out of 10 or 90%, and that. In secondary school, you just won't be getting those grades right the way through. The work will get harder, and the grades will start to settle out. And parents oftentimes feel that their grades are dropping, when in actual fact they're not dropping. It's just that the workload is getting tougher. Do you know what I mean? And so for parents, it's something that I wouldn't be getting overly anxious about. And if there is issues with teachers or clashes or certain things, there's things that we can kind of build into the day that can help, and things like movement breaks. Like, hugely, like, some of the research that come in out now around children who are allowed to move for regular periods during the day, their capacity to learn and sit and retain information is greatly improved. Not just children with a diagnosis that requires that, but all children benefit from movement breaks throughout the day. And so there's lots of things that we can think about that makes the school system a little bit more accommodating for children who might have particular struggles with that. But for me, if there is a school avoidance issue, early identification of it, try and find what the issue is behind the behavior. Get in touch with the school. Try and creatively collaborate on a way that can maybe support the child with whatever aspect of that they're struggling with. But it's prompt response. It is easier to go in having missed a day or two than a month or two. And again, we have to understand that in some cases, things like homeschooling and things they're down the line, but they are solutions that some people would recommend, and that's an option too. But in the first instance, try and allocate the issue and support them to, with the support of the teacher and the school and yourselves, to try and help them to feel less threatened while they're in there.
There's a question came in here, or a point, and it's like sometimes I've seen it so many times before, and it's always with boys in these cases. It's like, it's my son who's 14, struggles with anxiety. He's in a great mood all summer and eating well, and we're all getting along well. The moment school starts, he eats less and stops talking. I know he's a good student and I don't pressure him, but I'm looking for help on how to get him to open up to me. Right. And he's in second year. Like, I hear that so much with boys, that like there's clearly something amiss, something's wrong emotionally there. But how do you get a boy? Now, I'm not saying it's not a girl issue too, but how do you talk to your child if they don't want to talk to you?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't assume that they don't want to talk as the first instance, right? So some young people, children, generally tends to be boys, don't have the terms to describe how they feel, right? So if you're saying, they'll say things like, it's rubbish, or I feel tired, or I'm annoyed, and that could mean a multitude of things, but they don't have the lexicon of terms to describe that. Actually, when I'm in school, I find, the fear of speaking out in class really, I terrified someone's going to ask me to speak in class. They might be very capable, their results might be very good, but that might be an element of it. They might be sitting in a class where there's people sitting behind them that make them feel nervous, or they unnerve. So it's really hard to for younger teenagers especially to articulate, this is what I'm struggling with. So if you think about it, as adults, you feel, you think, and you do. Oftentimes in teenagers, there's lots of feelings, lots of doing, but not an awful lot of thinking around that, and not able to express it. So rather than assuming that your child doesn't want to talk to you, maybe they can't. And so from that perspective, what I would be saying is, all you can do is have that open door, approachable, philosophy with them, that anything that they have to say is, and I wouldn't pursue. I mean, the more you pursue, the more they'll recoil, because it's not about an interrogation. And oftentimes we do this when a child comes back from school. They sit in the car. How was school? Who are you talking to? How is this? How is that? They're just decompressing from a really busy day. That's not the time to have that conversation. Give them some food. Give them some time to decompress. Later on, get an hour and a half, then have a conversation. Oftentimes we'll say, talk to them when you're driving somewhere or walking the dog where it's side by side. Doesn't feel like they're flashing a light in your face, and I want your answers. But in the what I would say to every parent, and this is where you can't go wrong, approach your child with two things: curiosity and empathy. Curiosity around not what's going on, what's wrong, but I wonder what that's like for you. We saw you here all summer. You were in such great form. Now you don't seem to be eating. You seem to be not, sleeping so well. That must be really difficult. That's a different thing than what's going on. Give me the answer. It's an empathy and it's a curiosity around, I wonder what we could do to help that. And so even just the way in which, sometimes a teenager will give out to you about, I hate this teacher and I hate this subject, I hate this thing. Oftentimes saying to them, do you want me to fix this or do you just want me to listen? Because sometimes they just want you to listen. They don't want you to go, oh no, Mr. Saunders is brilliant. He's the great best teacher in there. Don't, or trying to shut them down. And that's a very natural instinct on a parent's behalf, is to try and fix or to try and balance it out. Sometimes it's just about asking them, do you want some advice here, or do you just want to blow off some steam? Because either is fine, and I'm fine with both. But curiosity and empathy, there's something about that lad, he's struggling to readjust into a system that maybe doesn't suit him. That's where you're seeing the flags are, the appetite going, that he's quieter in himself. And j just because he's not talking to you doesn't mean he doesn't want to. It may be that it's not all, there's a difference between a child who's unwilling and unable. And as a parent, being able to distinguish between those two things will really help you in terms of how you respond to it. An unwilling child needs something, an unable child needs something else.
Interesting. Yeah, and just a reminder, and for the late joiners, that this session is being recorded, and we will be sending a recording afterwards. So that hopefully answers that question. If you do have any questions that you want to me to put to Colman, please just drop them in the chat. I'm not guaranteeing I'll get to every one of them, but I will try and cover the broad themes and that I'm seeing coming up. I had an interesting kind of, as I mentioned before, like almost a lens into my future, where I had a 16-year-old boy staying in our house for a couple of weeks at summertime, and he was studying for exams, right? And I watched him, right? Because obviously I run a study website and I don't have a 16-year-old in my house. And I was kind of really been conscious of it. And I watched him trying to study. And I was, what really hit home was just how distracted he was by everything, right? Like he wasn't able to just kind of work away in a kind of self-directed way. And he had a laptop open. He was randomly typing things into ChatGPT every so often. Then he'd open a book and he'd highlight things. It was so disorganized the way he was approaching it. And my and then he would stop after about 20 minutes and he'd be like, I'm going up to the shop. And I remember thinking, like, is he my your instant reaction as a parent, as an adult, is he's lazy, right? But then when I actually thought about it, I had a bit of an epiphany, and I was like, he's actually a result of the last 10 years of the modern world. He's on his phone the whole time. He's looking at Snapchat. It's like his whole brain has been programmed to not focus on things for very long. And it really was an eye-opener, and it was something like you kind of have to see it to believe it. And I'm sure there's gazillions of parents here tonight who are like, you know, welcome to the 21st century, Luke. But I was just really shocked at when I saw it in action. And yeah, I think there's a lot of just empathy, I suppose. It's not just that they're lazy, it's actually that they've grown up in an era where YouTube was on demand and their phone was constantly trying to keep them, you know, flicking on to the next thing. Is there anything, I suppose, to turn that into a question, is there anything that a parent can do to kind of help a child who clearly is, you know, like we do it on study, because we do surveys and we ask students, you know, open your phone, have a look at the screen time app, how many hours a day? Like, it's quite common there's students out there with 7 or 8 hours and they're looking at the phone way into the night hours. Is there anything you could do if your child, the kind of the ship has sailed with the whole thing about, oh, we're going to do screen time limits and 40 minutes per day, like I'm trying to do with my daughter at the moment. What can you do to kind of pull back on this when it's kind of out of control on the phone use and the distractions?
Well, the answer to that is where do you start? And I wouldn't start here. You know, it would be my advice. You know, oftentimes it is about trying to create healthier habits when a child is younger, so that they develop a kind of a healthier relationship with technology. But we're living in a world where there is a constant assault on our attention, right? And our attention is something that I think we completely undervalue, you know, in terms of how we decide or choose to, where we decide or choose to put our attention is something that, you know, should be within the power of all of us to decide, but oftentimes it isn't, because you're getting notifications, you're getting these constant distractions. And that fragmentation of attention is, of course, it impacts on your capacity to learn, in terms of perseverance, in terms of sticking with something. And, you know, I always use the example of when you, and maybe you're probably of an age that might understand this as well, when you used to go down to Extravision to get your movie, and you came home and you put it on and you waited, and you know, it was a slow burner, but you persevered with it because there was no other option. Whereas now you're watching something and you don't like the opening credits and you switch to something else. And that tyranny of choice is not good for our brains from the point of view of that. So, you know, we've tried to look at education and say, well, how can we make education more like technology, that it's much more fast-paced and we don't have these long periods to almost kind of play to the teenage brain in some respects, that would work. A lot of the evidence coming out now, as we've a few years into that, is that technology isn't necessarily helping learning as much as we'd hoped it to be. So again, your brain, like the muscle, needs that time to work and to build. And so things like frustration tolerance, something like boredom, something like the tolerance of stillness, quietness, all of those things have to be practiced. And so, you know, and a lot of teenagers that I would see would say, I can't study without my phone. Do you know what I mean? I need, and like listening to YouTube or music or something in the background. And they're claiming that that's helping them to learn better. As a parent, you're kind of saying, well, I don't think that should or could. And then you end up having a row about the phone, which means they lose out on more study time. For me, again, it's not about, you know, we can't enforce this stuff in many ways, because again, I think what you're working with is a societal issue rather than one within your child or your home. But I would be encouraging as much time as possible to build that level of perseverance, to build their frustration tolerance, to try and stay on task for as long as they can. The issue here is that how we grow as human beings is we experience what's called surmountable stress, right? And surmountable stress is enough stress that pushes us, but not overwhelms us. And so you want a child to be experiencing surmountable stress where they're outside their comfort zone and they're building a little bit. And again, I go back to the idea of, you know, if you wanted to get fitter, you know, you try and build every time you run a little bit further every day, you're couched to 5K or whatever it is that you're doing, you're trying to create that. The brain is the same. It's just about trying to build from where you're at rather than where you think you should be. And it is, I do think this is a game of inches, you know, and it's
Yeah.
like, if you can manage a half an hour, let's see if you can do 35 minutes. If you can do 35, let's try 34, you know, rather than saying, Bill down the road, or John down the road, or Mary down the road does 4 hours a night. You do 20 minutes. I want you to do 4 hours. You know, you're not going to go from 20 minutes to 4 hours. it's going to take a little bit more time for than that. Do you know what I mean? Little incremental steps.
Yeah, and actually, at this point, I might there's an app. Whenever I'm speaking with students, I always promote this app. It's not a StudyClicks thing; it's separate. But I think it's worth just highlighting it here. It's called the Forest app. It's free. It's on iOS and Android. But basically, what it allows the student to do is set a timer for, say, a 25-minute study block or a 30-minute study block, and the idea being that if you don't pick up your phone for that 30 minutes, it plants a tree in your virtual forest. And if you do, then it kills one of your trees. It's just a really nice way of making your child aware of the importance of staying focused and working in these little kind of blocks of time. So, like when I'm speaking with students, it's like step one, make a study plan. Step two, take out Forest app and set a 25-minute block. Work on 20 for 25 minutes on a certain task. Great, there, and they get this feeling of reward, and it's like, okay, I've actually achieved that. I've done a quiz in science, or I've gone over the key themes of Macbeth, or whatever it might be. The other thing, as a parent, I always recommend, and I actually say this to students as well, is take screen time out on your phone and just have a good look at how much time you're spending using your phone. And when the child realizes, hang on, I'm spending 4.5 hours on TikTok on average this week per day, they will actually make the leap themselves and go, maybe that's too much. I'm actually going to control that a little bit. So kind of self-awareness can be really helpful, particularly as the student gets a little bit older. And just while I have the screen, I might just show you, excuse me, I might just show you, for a lot of parents, StudyClicks may be new to them, particularly the younger students, just what this is, this tool that they have access to, right? So the student gets access to StudyClicks by logging in with their school email address or their personal email address, however they're set up. First thing I'll just show you is here how to study, right? So we believe that it's important to try and help students learn that skill set of how to study. So this is freely available for every student, or every parent can get this. If you just go in there and go start the course, you'll see a kind of, it's a bite-sized kind of 5 or 6 part series. It can be a nice thing to sit down with your child and work through it with them. They're all 5 minutes long. It's not a huge time investment. You might find it helpful for them. If a student is studying, let's say maths, I'm going to go into junior maths because a lot of younger students here, or sorry, younger parents. If I go into junior maths, you're going to see things like, let's say, for example, a child is in first year and they're struggling with factorizing. They've got the exam questions there. Now, I'm not expecting a first year to be gone through loads of exam questions, like do the mock question from 5 years ago. No, they don't do that. That would be more for third years. But if they do, they have a video solution there to help them. But really, what a lot of students use is these things called boosts, which are just kind of video tutorials of a teacher walking through all the topics, so that if a child wants to go back over something or fill that learning gap that they've identified, then they can go and do that. And some students, they, like I always think StudyClicks is very good for students who are very self-motivated, right? They're very driven, they can work themselves. There's a lot of students who need support from teachers, and they need their own teachers to work through things or suggest what they should be doing on a service like StudyClicks. So you will see teachers might share certain items with students that they want them to look at. And in addition to that, some students want additional support to that, and they want this kind of live aspect to their teaching. And there's a new product or a new offering we're putting out in the coming days called StudyClicks Live for that exact purpose. It's going to support students in certain areas that they need additional help in. So you can check that out if you want. It's called live.studyclicks.ie. So just one other thing. I have a question here, Colm, which is quite interesting. And I think I mentioned this before, that we do surveys, right? And a parent here said something quite interesting. So over the years, I've really noticed that AI is now part of our lives, right? And we in our surveys ask, have you used AI in your schoolwork, right? Now, back in 2023, it was 1 in 5, right? And at the time that I remember reading that, going, oh my God, 1 in 5, 20% of students are using AI. That's crazy. It's so high. That's now, last year we did the survey again, it was 4 in 5. And I would su suggest that this year, there's literally students cannot not use it. It's like it's even part of Google now. It's like if they Google something, AI results are coming back. And I suppose I see a parent has asked the question here in this space, right? So, and it's quite an interesting perspective. It's basically that her son has said, why should I study anymore if there is no point? From his perspective, everything we know or may learn in the future could eventually be replaced by AI. There's a really interesting point. It's like, you know, how do you answer that one? So yeah, like I suppose AI is huge now in education. And I think when we spoke before, you said something which really was an eye-opener for me, that I always look at AI as like, oh, it's you know, I'm genuinely very worried about whether my children can get a job. Because you know, AI is going to take a lot of jobs. And I was always focused on the jobs. But you said something quite interesting to me about other effects of AI. We might just touch on that if that's okay.
Yeah, I suppose as a psychotherapist, I'm kind of more interested in the kind of relational trade-offs involved in AI. And that question you got about the kid saying there's no point in working because AI is going to do everything for you. I had another circumstance where a young man who's saying to me that there's no point in putting a lot of effort into writing an English essay because the teachers will just think it's AI. Do you know what I mean? From the point of view, and like I used the example, I gave a TED talk on this recently, and I was giving the example of if a couple have an argument and they go away, and the man comes back later and he gives this wonderful apology about how he realizes what he's done, he's thought about it, it won't happen again, and tells his wife partner, you know, you're the most important person in my life. And at first she's very pleased about this, but then she finds out he got the apology from ChatGPT. So what does the apology mean now? And in another circumstance, a man might go away and have a think about it, comes back and gives a similar type of apology. And what if his partner thinks, did he get that from ChatGPT? Do you know what I mean? So the idea is that what AI has done is it has removed our ability to know where human effort begins and ends. Do you know what I mean? How much of this is your own? So whether it's an email that you get from somebody that's using words that they don't usually use, or an essay or an assignment or whatever it might be, there's now an air of scrutiny around or distrust around the work that we produce. And in school, and I hear students saying this all the time, you know, around, you know, I don't know what's real anymore, you know. And again, when you think in AI and the world of deep fakes and all the sort of stuff, we're living in almost like an age of illusion where we can't trust our eyes, we can't trust, and all of that sort of stuff. But for me, the interpersonal issue, and I think this is, I'd like to say this now before we finish, like friendships and connections are the most important aspects of school experience. If you have, I can t tell you, I can, if there's a young person with a particular mental health difficulty and they're trying to navigate the 6 years of school and they have one or two really good friends, they'll manage that really kind of optimally from that perspective. Another child who has a very similar level of difficulty is trying to navigate it without the support of those friends. It's a completely different journey. So if we're talking about looking after the well-being of our children, investing in their friendships and their connections and their support systems within a school is hugely, hugely important. And for me, the issue with AI is that it's almost removing an element of connection through friendships. So if you give you an example of a young person who would normally ask a friend something, they'll now ask ChatGPT. I'll give you an example. A young girl, she's in her 20s, she was chatting to me and she was getting ready to go on a date and she didn't know whether to wear trousers or jeans. So she asked ChatGPT, should I wear the trousers or the jeans? And ChatGPT said, because it's a date, you should probably wear the trousers. And I said to her, what would you have done before? And she said, well, I would have texted my friend Sophie, sent her a picture of me wearing the trousers, me wearing the jeans. She would have said, they're both nice, but I'd probably go with the trousers, but I know you well and you'll be more comfortable in the jeans. So go with the jeans. The issue for me is AI has the risk of taking Sophie out of the equation, right? And if we don't ask our neighbors, our friends, anything, because we'll just go to a YouTube tutorial instead, or whatever that might be, if all of our friendships and connections are made through those little micro gestures, asking for help. So in the school setting, where's the next class? Do you have the homework for tomorrow? What's these little tokens of exchange allow these kind of minutiae moments build into friendships. You're far more likely to become friends with someone you see regularly all the time rather than someone who shares exactly the same interests as you. And school is a wonderful microcosm of that. And for Luke, the big issue that I'm seeing is that once children leave primary school, their secondary school experience is a lonely one, and they're not maybe making time to meet up with friends after school. Lots of people will say, I don't have time. I have rugby on Monday, soccer on Tuesday, guitar on Wednesday. And at the weekends, they maybe don't know how to say, do you want to come over to my house, or do you want to go to the park, or do you want to do those things? And, so they're only seeing people in school. For me, if you're looking after the well-being of your child, and I know the study's important, and I know the school's classroom is important, but their friendships are crucially important too. And for me, it's really about trying to encourage them to try and make those connections, because those are the things that will get them through the adversity when it inevitably happens. And my worry is that AI and technology are almost removing those opportunities for us to, if I rang my sister recently and said, come here, how do you make French toast? And she told me, and she said, why didn't you just YouTube it? And I said, because I wanted to talk to you. Do you know what I mean? It's
Yeah, I
almost
know.
like the we cannot remove the human connection, because if we lose that, we become disjointed. And if we become disjointed, we become lonely. And that's loneliness is worse than smoking 10 cigarettes a day in terms of our long-term well-being. And we need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to allow their children to grow up in communities and tribes and villages, and creating those as much as we can,
Yeah, I think you touched on probably the most important point of everything we'll say tonight, which is like their well-being comes first, and social interactions is the most important thing, and that can be between their own family group, but also their friends. And that's, I think it's really important to point that point, that we as parents can actually help our child by bringing them to see their friend or whatever it might be. And just, we all have done the taxi service around the place to make things happen, but it is important, and it does. It, you're investing in your child's mental health by doing those things, and we probably don't think of it that way at the time, but it certainly is important. I see a
And just
question.
sorry, what just
Go
one
on,
last
yeah.
thing. I would try and sell the benefit of just hanging out.
Yeah.
Oftentimes people say, well, why don't you ask your friends over? And they'll say, to do what? To do nothing. That's the beauty of it. Like, I don't know whether about you, but I spent 90% of my adolescence doing nothing but in the company of other people. And, almost we need to allow children to have those downtime spaces to do nothing together, rather than it all being focused and driven and scheduled, if that makes any sense.
No, totally. I agree with that. The kind of, yeah, and making their own fun or making their own activities. I see a lot of questions coming in. A theme that's certainly popping up a lot is supporting a child with ADHD. Now, I don't know if they've had a diagnosis of ADHD or they suspect it, but it's come up a lot. Just essentially saying that like our exam system and our school system isn't ideal for someone with ADHD. I don't know if you've come across that in your work, or any advice to that type of parent.
Yeah, I mean, again, any challenge, whether it's ADHD, ASD, dyslexia, dyscalculia, all of those things create a greater challenge to engaging with an education system than if than you didn't. Whether it's your attention, your ability to decipher words or numbers, whatever it might be. And so lots of those children will need a different opportunity or a way to learn. Now, that's not always possible. School is a very one size is all that's available to all, and we can't have it would be chaos if there were all different ways in doing that. But within schools, and I have to give credit to a lot of schools, there's a lot of creative thinking around how we can manage to support children as best they can by altering how they learn, maybe altering how you assess things, all of those sorts of things. But we've a little bit done, but a lot more to do. We have to appreciate that, and we'll see this in families. You might have one child who goes into school, just they read it, they learn it, they retain it, and it's done. What I would say in all of those situations is value effort, not outcome, right? So you have one child who maybe has a difficulty with dyslexia or whatever the case, and another child who doesn't. The child who doesn't For them, homework is 10 minutes scanning over their spellings for the next day. In they hop 10 out of 10. The other child is spending an hour and 45 minutes going over those same 10 spellings, trying to learn them, and they get 6 out of 10. If all we see is 6 and 10, we're valuing outcome over effort. Effort is where children need to be recognized. For a child to get from 50% to 55 is a wonderful achievement if they've worked hard for it, you know, rather than just seeing it as a net or end result. And as parents and as schools and as teachers and as a school community, if we could concentrate more on effort rather than outcome, I think what children need to feel is a sense of belonging and that their effort is valued or worthwhile. And it doesn't always have to be the same effort. Like my effort might get me 60%, your effort might get you 90, but the effort may well be the same. And so for me, it's about the school community, the parenting support system around that child, and the peers, their peers within their classroom, having a kind of a supportive system around that, to let's start valuing effort rather than outcome. We've become so outcome focused as a society. What did you get? Think of every child playing sport. When they come off the field, they ask, "Did you win? Did you score?" They're the wrong questions to ask. Do you know what I mean? And the same when it comes to leaving certs and what points did you get and what course are you doing in honors, maths, and all. You know, for some kid to pass maths might have taken such a huge effort rather than someone who is naturally good at maths and cruises through the honors. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I suppose one thing, and we're kind of drawn to a close shortly. So please do put in any additional questions you have. Hopefully, I've got to lots of the ones that came up or a lot of the themes. If I didn't answer your question, apologies, and we will put them together and hopefully do a second webinar where we talk through these types of things. Just at the other end of the spectrum, like we've a lot of students, I've seen this a lot with the younger year groups, first and second years, where a child will come into first year and they will have been a 10 out of 10 in every spelling test type student, and then suddenly they expect perfection, and that really bothers them if they can't, and it makes them anxious. So it's the opposite end of the spectrum of a student who's struggling with motivation. It's actually that they're struggling with any imperfections. Have you any advice for a parent in that case? Because it does happen quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, again, the drive for perfection is it that can be a very personal one. So sometimes parents are coming to me with a perfectionistic child saying, "We put no pressure on him or her. This is all coming from within themselves." Perfectionism is usually much more concerned rather than a desire to get it right. It's a fear of getting it wrong, if that makes sense. So the ability to is not about trying to be less perfect, but to be more tolerant of mistakes. And I spoke about this a lot. In the last, I would say, 10 years, we've seen the word average change its meaning, right? So we talk about only average or just average and everyone wanting to be above average. By nature of maths, everyone can't be above average. That's not how that works, right? But for me, like if you have 10 children in a room, one might be exceptional, one might struggle, and the other eight are average. Do you know what I mean? But if we say that average is not enough, we consign 80% of the population to feeling not enough. It is really time that we, all of us, and again, as a school system, as a parenting system, as a society, catch on to ourselves. Average is something to be celebrated and should be met with relief, not disappointment. And from the point of view of that's us as parents, how we approach things, but also within the child needs to know that I can't have my best game every time. No sports person, even the best in the world, plays their best every time. The ability to tolerate errors, mistakes, comes from a good sense of self and self-worth that my value isn't determined by whether I get 100% or not. There are other things. And again, as humans and adults, we probably think, you know, if we're having a bad day, you'll go, "Well, that wasn't my finest hour, but I'm a good dad. I'm a good brother. I try and do my best with this." And we kind of, you know, we we see the crisis in the context of other things. Teenagers oftentimes can't see that. They just see the crisis. Your job as a parent is to try and manage that. And I just saw briefly some of the questions coming up, a lot of them about anxiety. Here's a tip. Anxious people do two things. When you're anxious, you overestimate the challenge and you underestimate your own ability. So what you've got to do as the parent of an anxious child is to try and put the challenge in perspective and remind them of their own ability. So this is a second year geography test. It is not the end of the world. You know, I know it's a big thing to you, but this is not, you know, life and death. This is your happiness doesn't depend on this moment. And then you remind them of their own ability. You've done really well so far. You've put in the work. You have, you know, I'm absolutely confident that you have done enough for this, you know, rather than saying, I'm absolutely sure you'll get 100%. By putting the challenge in perspective and reminding a child of their own ability is the best way to counter a set of anxious spiraling thoughts. And I know that sounds quite simple, but it's the simplicity of it that makes it effective. So if you have an anxious child, they're overestimating the challenge, underestimating their own ability, and you're trying to counter that by balancing it out.
Yeah, I think that's really, really good. Simple advice, but really, really good. I might just at this point just show the parents on the call where they can access all this stuff, right? So you will be emailed after the call. excuse me, tomorrow we'll do an edit of today's call. I'm going to break it up into bite-sized chunks. But if you go to the footer of StudyClicks, right? Just go to studyclicks.ie. You don't have to log in or anything to access this. And if you click on Parent Center, you're going to find a lot of resources there that we've built for you as a parent that might be helpful to you. There's that How to Study series I mentioned. We have things like there's a guide for studying for students with dyslexia. We'd always partner with an expert in those various areas. We'll put up Coleman's webinar in there. There's just nice resources there that can help you. They're all freely available. Like I said, you don't need a login for them. If you have any questions around, you know, does my school have access to StudyClicks and so on? If you email us at our kind of main chat, info@studyclicks.ie, we'll be able to answer those types of questions. If your school doesn't have StudyClicks for this, you know, through the school, you can obviously always buy it yourselves. We try and make it affordable. It's, you know, plans start at $59.99 for a year. So you do have access to that. As I said, there's a new service launching this week called StudyClicks Live. You can check that out if you're interested in getting kind of ongoing support for your child, just in kind of subjects where they need additional support. And I would also suggest that you'll see this in the Parent Center, but we have a WhatsApp channel where you'll get notifications about various events like the one we did tonight. But keep an eye on your email. Well, as I said, we're going to send the recording. You can catch up on that. So, guys, thanks for all the contributions. I'd like to thank Coleman for his time. I thought that was really insightful. I suppose the key things I took from it as a parent myself is like curiosity and empathy when you're speaking with your child about anything school related, and I suppose anything. Friendships first, the most important thing that. You know, it's this the you know the, your child is happy, I suppose, comes first. And then I really like that last point you made, Coleman, about reminding them of their ability. I just thought that's a really good takeaway. So look, thanks again, and hopefully we'll do this again. And thanks for everyone who did join us tonight.
And that wraps up the webinar. Thank you for listening. If you found what was discussed in this webinar helpful, please share it with a friend. If you'd like to see more from Dr. Coleman Nochter, you can follow him on Instagram at Nochter Coleman. And don't forget to check out the Parent Centre on StudyClicks, which has tons of free resources to help parents support their children through secondary school. Bye for now.